Today I'm here with Barney Ramaswamy. I've known her for quite some time. We've done quite a bit of work together and she's one of our superb experts in physiopedia who's made some fantastic contributions to physiopedia. So we're hoping to chat to her today a little bit about Parkinson's disease. So hello, Barney.
Hello. Nice to be here.
Nice to have you with us. So just first of all, for our listeners, people listening that haven't met you before or don't know who you are, would you be okay just to let everyone know who you are and what you get up to?
Yes, I suppose the one thing I always write about myself is I'll put in one sentence, I just let people know that I'm an independent physiotherapy consultant. And I work mainly in the UK, both lecturing and clinical work. And that kind of nutshells it. But if people want to know a little bit more, I
yes,
make sure
please.
They know that I'm an Indian, although I think I'm obviously Welsh because I grew up there. I'm the internationally negotiated correct height, which is 5'2¾". And apart from that, I love my work. And I guess that's what people need to know about me.
It's very true. Knowing you, everybody knows how much you love your work and what a massive influence you've had on the profession. And I must just congratulate you on your recent fellowship to the Chartered yes. Society of Physiotherapy for the work that you have done. So you haven't actually told us which clinical areas you work in. So tell us a little bit about the clinical areas you're working in and how you came about to get this fellowship from the Chartered Society of Physiotherapy.
Yes. My sort of area of practice, main practice, is working with older people. And I think I got my love of that from my father. He was a consultant geriatrician. And a lot of our family have worked with older people. So I guess that's kind of in my blood. I also tell people that when Dad first worked here, it was at the time when we didn't have the same stringent health and safety that we do now. So as a child, I used to follow him on weekends on his ward rounds onto the ward. And I just loved being around older people. Because we were brought up in the UK, whereas our grandparents were in India at the time. So I think it was just lovely for me to see the older people. And of course, they love young children. And being a greedy little souse, I used to always sit and they'd chat and I'd eat their chocolates. So I think my love of working with older people kind of stems right from an early age. So I'd like to say that, you know, it was the influence of my dad, but I do think my greed had a little bit to do with it. So I think my career followed that of any therapist. I qualified in Cardiff in 1988, so that's in Wales for people who don't know. And I did my clinical rotations. I actually went to America for a couple of years because I felt that I just wanted to travel more. I wanted to see the world, and at the time I actually thought I'd stay in America. And I think the big difference there at the time, I don't know how it's changed now, but when they talk about rehabilitation, it's so holistic that, you know, I'd already started to specialise in the UK into neurological rehabilitation, and that was just 3 years after I'd qualified. Whereas whilst I was in America, if you did rehabilitation, went across the age spectrum. So suddenly I was back dealing with children, adolescents. It was rehabilitation across amputees, right through to older people and neurology, orthopedics. You know, so it just crossed all the boundaries. And it meant that although I felt that the rotations in the UK helped me consolidate what I had learnt as an undergraduate, the one thing that I did enjoy from America was, again, just being reminded about the holistic nature of, you know, all the things we'd learnt and all the things that we could transfer from skills across to a different area of practice. But then once I came back to the UK, it was back into this, you know, what specialisms almost straight away. And at the time, there was a job going in neurology, and that sort of started feeding back into something that was a quite a deep-seated interest. And also then I got a permanent role in older people. So geriatrics, older adults, it gets called different things.
So you've worked with older people throughout your whole career.
Yes,
Yeah.
yeah. Yes, and also, having sort of said that dad was a big influence, mum was another influence in that she's always done charity work. When we were growing up, she was an occupational therapy assistant in the day hospital that dad worked in. But because people couldn't pronounce our surname, she was always called by her first name. So no one ever knew she was dad's wife.
That's
Sorry about
funny.
my mum. So I kind of already got this whole mix of a love from, the geriatrics, mum with occupational therapy. She then injured her back, and I used to go and sit after work and watch her receive physiotherapy. So I think also that kind of multidisciplinary input and interest into what different professions could offer started creeping in also at an earlier age.
Yeah.
And she did a lot of charity work I was sort of mentioning, and I think that then led, when I started working in older people, to me taking up opportunities through the NHS of utilising, they had a voluntary policy. So you could actually work full time, but take a couple of hours off, as long as you paid it back in terms of, at lunch break, just quarter of an hour extra. And a colleague and I set up an exercise class for people with Parkinson's using that voluntary contract.
So when was
And I think
this?
this was when I was in Sheffield at the Northern General Hospital in 1999. So it
Yeah,
was,
that's when I worked there as well.
yes. So Rick and I think having worked on the hospital wards, I'd seen people being discharged after an acute admission, and if they needed it, we would then refer them on to the day hospital setup. So they then had outpatient rehabilitation. But after then going to classes for maybe 10 weeks, they were just discharged. And anyone with either a long-term condition or who was older, who was just getting into that, habit of starting to exercise regularly, to then just be discharged. There was nothing out there in the community. So it was Rick who sourced, this is Richard Webber, sorry. He sourced a place we could run classes, and we just started running them on a once a week voluntary. And that's sort of where, other interests crept in, that you realise that out in the community, it isn't just the NHS that provides opportunities.
Yeah.
We sort of had loads of untapped arenas to then take forward physiotherapy and interventions.
So were your classes, they weren't at the hospital, they were in the
No,
community.
yes,
Yeah.
we managed to find it was an old school, and actually that we nicknamed our classes the Full Monty Club. There was a film that people may or may not know that was, it was the Full Monty film, based on a group of Sheffield steelworkers.
Be careful what you say now, Barney.
Oh, yes, well, exactly, yes, who end up stripping off at the end. But one of the places that they filmed was where we used to run classes. And we
Okay.
asked people who attended the classes, instead of just saying an exercise class for people with Parkinson's, what did they want to call themselves? And they named themselves the Full Monty
Oh,
Club.
that's funny.
But it's, subsequently, people have such different ideas, because those who were, served in the Second World War, for some of them, a full Monty was the large breakfast where it meant you were served everything. The full Monty before you then went on a day out where you may not get any meal. And other people, a full Monty was the three-piece suit you wore, as opposed to then the three Monty for us was, of course, is stripping off. But we have to make it very clear to people that there is no nudity in our classes. So, yeah. And things just kind of went from strength to strength.
So is that when you start? So obviously you were working with Parkinson's disease patients throughout your career, but is that when you started to specialise more in Parkinson's disease?
Yes, in the late 90s, so I think it was about 96, I joined what's now the professional network for people, for physiotherapists working with older people, and that's Agile. Mm-hmm. So it's one of the Chartered Society of Physiotherapy. They used to be called special interest groups, clinical interest groups, but it's a, you know, a professional network. And I got roped into helping to run a course that was on Parkinson's, and that was 1999. And I think it became very obvious at that course that we just didn't know enough.
Okay. And
I'm one of these people that when I see that happening, I decided that I would do something and set about improving this situation. And at around the time from Newcastle, there was a large move to look at trying to provide guidelines for physiotherapists. And although Roberta Plant started heading that work, it was Anna Jones, so Dr. Anna Jones, who took that over.
Mm-hmm.
And
that was guidelines for older people or for Parkinson's?
No, sorry, these were Parkinson's.
Parkinson's, yeah.
But what made these unique was they asked 6 questions. So it was done in the way of a Delphi study initially. And they asked physiotherapists, what is it they would want to know? So the whole guidelines were based on 6 premises, you know, so things like physios would say, well, we don't know what we should be assessing. We don't know what should be the outcome measures. We're not sure who should be within our team. So it was those sort of very pragmatic questions. And I was very fortunate enough to be one of the experts on this Delphi study. And I think we, you know, took it forward. Because after that, the Cochrane review came up.
Okay.
And there were 2 Cochrane reviews. These were the Catherine Dean ones. And they highlighted the lack of effectiveness of physiotherapy for Parkinson's.
That must have been in around 2000 or something.
Yes, it was 2001 they were published.
Yeah.
And it was sort of the same year that the guidelines came out. So Anna Jones and I did a lot of work then through Agile and ACPIN. So for people who don't know, ACPIN is the professional network for neurology for the Chartered Society of Physiotherapy. And we basically ran 9 study days across the country for members of Agile and ACPIN to try and help translate these guidelines into clinical practice. Because I think one of the things that Anna is very, she feels strongly about is that we don't just sit guidelines on our shelves and let them get dusty. And if someone has produced them, we need to look at the evidence out there and transfer it into clinical practice. And it's people like that who have really influenced me. And I still always say I'm very clinical in my focus.
Mm.
And that I'll look at the evidence out there and always think about, well, what does it mean to me clinically?
Yeah. And that's a really good message to tell people, isn't it? It's people, there's so much evidence out there and so much published information and so many guidelines. And it's,
yes.
And people, you know, people need to read these guidelines now and sort of review them themselves to see how they can inform their own practice.
Yes. Yeah. And we're at this stage, I mean, you know, subsequently my opportunities through the NHS were amazing. I acted as the physiotherapist for the guideline development group on the UK's NICE guidelines for Parkinson's.
Okay, yeah.
And they're actually being currently updated. And Fiona Lindop, who is another of the physiotherapists whose name a lot of people will know if they're in Parkinson's, she's the current guideline development group physiotherapist, so for this update. And both Fiona and I over the years have taken opportunities to act as sort of project officers for various projects that have come up. Me particularly for general older people issues, and Fiona as well for either Parkinson's or movement disorder.
Mm-hmm.
So, One of the things that people listening might sort of pick up on is I'm not keen on the word disease. It's just something in the UK that a few years ago, a lot of the younger people who have Parkinson's fought a campaign
to just say that.
Yeah, so that there's quite a stigma attached to if you say, I've got a disease. And they found that they didn't want to be associated with something that people stepped back from and didn't know how to respond. And that's when Parkinson's UK had changed its name and its messaging from being the Parkinson's Disease Society to Parkinson's UK.
So this is really interesting because whenever I've been writing anything in Physiopedia or anything, I've always thought, oh, I must call it Parkinson's disease. I mustn't shorten it.
Ah, but you will find that there's a slow sea change. Yeah. But what's very interesting is if you look at things like the European Parkinson's Disease Association, so the EPDA, although their name and logo is fixed, when they write in their magazine, if they're writing from the perspective of someone who's actually diagnosed with the condition, they only say Parkinson's. Whereas if it's a health professional or someone in social care, they will always refer to it as Parkinson's disease because it's quite a medicalized model to sort of name something by its root of degeneration or deterioration. But I sit on the European guidelines, so that is due out any moment now. And we have on that, on the committee, there are two people who actually have Parkinson's. And they argued that they wanted it to remain Parkinson's disease. Because in Europe, mainland Europe, sorry, there's quite a feeling that without it being given such a grave name or title, a lot of the neurologists won't take as much or won't take it seriously.
Yeah, and maybe that might have some sort of influence on research funding and things like that, I suppose.
Yes. Yeah. But, in the UK, you'll find a lot of people will say, well, they don't call it that I've got diabetic disease. It's enough to say I've got diabetes, but there is cardiovascular disease. So it's very interesting listening to how people feel they're responded to in terms of a label they're given, but it's not multiple sclerosis disease.
So do you think there'll be a change to call it Parkinson's instead of Parkinson's disease?
I don't actually think it's our call as the health professionals. It's very much up to the perception of the person who has the condition.
Yeah,
because
point.
And it's quite comical. If I go to meetings, there are some people who go, "Oh, I've got Parkies," and you see other people bridle, and they're just bristling away and thinking, "I've not got Parkies. I'm not a Parkie. I am someone who is living with Parkinson's." But others will say, "I'm a victim. I'm suffering," and it's just so subjective, isn't it? It's a personalised issue.
Yeah. Absolutely.
So, I don't know. Can't answer that question. But I do see a slow change in the way it's written in a lot of places. And I'll read papers, and occasionally when the students, I do some work at Sheffield Hallam University, and if the students write anything, I will always say to them, "Can you please call it Parkinson's whilst you're in the UK?" And then just put a footnote to explain. And Parkinson's UK have sort of provided a statement explaining why the preference to call it Parkinson's as opposed to Parkinson's disease. It was just a sort of, an interesting aside because I do like
it. Yeah, that's really interesting. Yeah, really interesting. And it's often something that I think about when I'm writing, whether how to write that term. And also when you're writing things, I always write individuals with Parkinson's disease. It's that term as well, how to describe somebody who has Parkinson's. That's always a difficult one. And again, like you say, it's really subjective, so you're not going to please everybody when you're writing, but
no.
what the standard form is. It's an interesting discussion.
Yes, yeah.
Yeah. And so going back to the guidelines, all these guidelines, yeah. So you've got up to European guidelines that are new guidelines that are about to come out now. Are they updated or are they new ones?
They're a little bit of both. In 2004, the Dutch Society, they actually produced, they're amazing. They just have this proliferation of guidelines galore.
They do.
And they did one for Parkinson's disease at the time, and it was translated into English in 2006. And they became adopted across the world for physiotherapists who worked with the condition. In 2009, in the UK, we asked for permission to just alter some of the measures of outcome because they were obviously pertinent to the people in the Netherlands. And they included things like cycling and, you know, someone living in most of the UK where it's quite hilly, especially Sheffield, you know, cycling isn't something that's common. So the one thing that's been brilliant about the guidelines is they have what they call four quick reference cards. So the first one is about history taking. The second one is about physical activity. And so they suggest measures. The third one actually takes you through what would be evidence-based or recommended treatment suggestions. And the fourth one actually looks at strategies that you might use depending on what you found with the person. And so it was those that we kind of said, could we adapt them into a UK-specific quick reference card, which we did in 2009. And I think one of the things that I've also been lucky with, you know, it's not just the NHS, but because the UK is small enough, you can, you know, you get to meet all the people that you would put up on pedestals or you'd call your little gurus of Parkinson's. So we had this... but we had this wonderful mix of people who were still very active only clinically. So you had your Fiona Lindops. There were people like myself. You had people who were then academics and researchers. So you've got your Vicky Goodwins, your Anne Ashburns, Lynn Rochester, Anna Jones, who are mixes of, yes, they've got a clinical background. So when you look at their research these days, they are very specific to what we can do in home settings, what we can do in outpatient settings or in the community, far more than they used to be, you know, even 10 years ago when it was a lab-based experimental design.
Yeah.
So I think we've become far more able. Do you know, I've now happily lost my thread. Where was I? Oh, yes, back onto. Yeah, so it was just the fact that you had this group that you could pass and discuss and network with for information. And so, you know, changing and utilizing these quick reference cards, we then slowly found that most of us were members at the time as well of a group called the Association of Parkinson's Disease or Physiotherapists in Parkinson's Disease in Europe. So that's the APPDE. We love our acronyms, don't we?
Yeah, you do.
So as part of that, we found once we'd converted and done a UK adaptation, Italy asked the Netherlands, could they do one? Yeah. Switzerland asked the Netherlands. So in a way, the APPDE stemmed this change where the Netherlands said, well, the guidelines are now, they were coming up to 10 years old. Well, they were 8 years old at the time. So they decided it was time for an update. But having had so much interest from across the countries of Europe, they said instead of just updating the Dutch guidelines, we really ought to do something that is pan-Europe or pan-European. And that's why, so they are an update, but they're done with 19 countries actually signed up across Europe.
That's so impressive. That's really good. It's so rare that you see countries working together to produce guidelines.
Yes.
There are so, you know, every country seems to have its own guidelines for things, and it's really nice to see countries collaborating and coming together to produce one document that brings everything together so we don't get confused by all the different guidelines that are out there.
Yes. I mean, it has been amazing because each of the 19 countries, their professional body has signed up to it.
Yes.
So you then have a chosen expert to either sit on the writing group, the reading group, just be a stakeholder. So it really has been a very diverse use of people.
And so that's really exciting. When those come out, where will people be able to find them?
I would always recommend this APPDE site.
Yeah.
So that's just, you know, the normal HTTP, I can't even say T, HTTP, then your colon, 2/ appde.eu, and there must be a www somewhere in
don't
there.
Don't worry, we'll add it to the information with this. Yes. Audio, so don't worry.
And they've got their own tab that is
okay,
that just says European guideline.
Yeah,
there's currently on that site, there's the penultimate version that people can still look at.
Okay,
get an idea of what's on.
Yeah,
but the actual version comes out supposedly either this or next week.
So and so the work, these European guidelines, is this some, because you did some really nice work in Physiopedia and added a lot of information about Parkinson's disease to Physiopedia. Does that come from the European guidelines information?
Yes, it's from various resources, but there were things that, yes, they have, there are certain charts that you'll see that we've had permission from the guideline publishers to actually produce a copy of a chart or a suggested framework. So we have had permission. But what we might have to do is when the actual guideline comes out, we will obviously change the reference and there might be an updated version of a chart. So yes, they were. So they're fairly up to date.
Yeah, so that's great. And that's a really nice area of Physiopedia, and we're grateful for you for contributing that. If anyone's listening, if you haven't had a look at the Parkinson's disease area of Physiopedia, it's amazing and it's a really good resource. And Barney was very involved in contributing that, so do take a look. Just talking about, so we've come, it's really interesting to hear you talk about how guidelines are developed, really, and we've come to a point where this European guideline is coming out. I'm just wondering if we can talk a little bit about the clinical side of managing patient individuals with Parkinson's. What do I say now? Are there any sort of key messages or you know, I haven't treated an individual with Parkinson's for a very long time, so I wouldn't know where to start with a Parkinson's patient with Parkinson's disease. What is it important for physios to know? Mm. What knowledge do they need to have to be able to effectively manage an individual with Parkinson's disease?
It's going to get deep trouble, isn't it?
Yeah, I know. I'm going to use every different term I can, and then I can't get in trouble. So, first of all, what kind of knowledge should physios interested in Parkinson's sort of try and obtain?
Yeah, I think one of the things that we are seeing change in our information or understanding, and this is very much work from people like Lynn Rochester. And there's a lady in a professor in Belgium, Alice Neubauer, and they've looked at the cognitive changes in people who have Parkinson's. And in the past, there was this suggestion from a team from Germany, Brack, and Brack's team found that the condition stemmed, 15 to 20 years before the actual observable physical manifestations.
Wow.
Showed. So you could have people who have either mood changes, changes to olfactory senses. So you get a lot of people saying, you know, my smell went 5-10 years ago, sleeping problems. So there are issues, you will find that they consider now to be these preclinical signs. But what Brack's model states is that as the condition progresses over the years, very slowly the changes pass up the brainstem through to this midbrain area, so the old basal ganglia, all those areas, the old areas, but then they become far more diffuse. So they will then pass not just to the frontal lobe, but they'll pass up to all the lobes of the brain, which explains very nicely to us why you get, you know, a room full of people with Parkinson's who all exhibit a different symptom at a different time, why medications affect one completely differently to another one. So the other thing about Brack's theory or Brack's model is that the end stage has to end in frank dementia. So we know that we used to think that it's only at the end stages you would have such cognitive decline that a person would then develop what they call, you know, Parkinson's with dementia. But what the work is showing now, and I think what physiotherapists need to think about now, is that the changes in our cognitive processing start far earlier than we ever thought. So, it certainly doesn't mean someone's going to develop dementia early or anything like that, but it's just we don't realise how their processing is slower. So as physiotherapists, we're often very chatty. We don't think twice about giving two or three instructions at one go, or expecting someone to remember the exercises you give them to go home with. But what we find for people with Parkinson's, and this would be my first message, is to think very carefully about the cognitive state of the person. They might just take it in more slowly. So therefore, I think we need to follow it up with far clearer instructions and possibly write down our instructions to, you know, make sure someone has the information to just go over in their own time when they're home, you know, if we want carryover. Mm-hmm. So for me, you know, just the understanding that the cognitive processes go earlier than we ever thought is one of the biggest changes to our understanding.
Is this going to have any implications for, I guess it's not predicting, but for diagnosing people with Parkinson's earlier?
I don't think about that way in the diagnosis, but certainly what they're starting to find is the patterns or categorizations for people with Parkinson's is very different to what we thought. Because before, if you thought about what a typical Parkinson's was, in our mind or in all the old textbooks, all you will see is someone fairly flexed with the poking chin, with, you know, a tremor and, you know, and although you will see this in a proportion of people, we're now able to categorize into someone who develops the condition earlier. So they might be in their 30s, their 40s. Now, for someone who is early in their diagnosis, the actual state, you know, they remain on a fairly steady state of deterioration for a far longer period. I mean, they could be 20 to 30 years with very little change or doing really well on basic medication for that amount of time. Whereas you might have someone in their 60s or 70s who within 5-6 years will show some decline.
Okay.
And you might have someone who's diagnosed when they're in their 80s that within a year is so poor in their both physical and mental state that they need to go into care. You know, the spouse cannot manage them at home and they will die within a couple of years. So we're now, and I think that has an impact on how we as physiotherapists will provide an idea of treatment, what we might sort of recommend in terms of referrals, adaptations, versus recommending exercise earlier rather than later.
Yeah. It's interesting, like you say in the textbooks, there's that textbook version of a person with Parkinson's disease and you think everybody's going to be like that. But in actual fact, there is a huge huge scope for lots of different presentations. And it's important that we know that and are able to use that when we're with people. So that's really interesting. So you mentioned you moved on to treatment a little bit. I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about how we manage people with Parkinson's disease these days. I know it's a huge question, but maybe there's a few key points that stand out.
Yeah, I think the other huge change is that we're finding that exercise, I mean, for any condition, not just Parkinson's, but more and more, the literature is just exponentially growing.
Yeah.
And the one thing that you will find in all of it is that exercise is very good. Now, what we're showing is that there is a window of opportunity at that point within the first, preferably year to 3 years after diagnosis from the physical manifestations.
Yeah.
And I think when they've done, you know how in America, well, in England as well, but in America, they followed a group of people who had cancer for 20 to 30 years. And actually they found for varied conditions that the more active people were, they were less likely to open their bodies, because they kept their immunity up, they were less likely to develop other sorts of conditions.
Mm-hmm.
So I suppose it might feel a bit too late, but if we can really push the physical exercise and physical activity agenda, that then reduces the likelihood of people actually getting Parkinson's.
Yeah.
But for those who've been diagnosed, the message is to actually do exercise at enough intensity to maintain both immunity, but also things like the neurotrophic factors in the brain, which assist with healing, learning. So all these things that will aid the cognitive state. So I think the biggest change is get to people early and push exercise. Now, as physiotherapists, I think we've always been really good at saying, you must do exercise. But what we're poor at doing is pushing them to the limit. So our exercise might be the equivalent of the physio tools. Go home, do something that strengthens your knee, or, you know, so that your knees don't bend, strengthen your buttocks so you're not bent over.
Yeah.
But we're talking about get up. They have all these, if you look on Google and look up the rocks, rock steady boxing group, and they're doing high intensity, coordination, fast pace. It's, you know, the things they're pushing people. And in Sheffield,
these are people with Parkinson's disease.
Yeah, you should see the things that they're being asked to do. And they've had Parkinson's for several years.
Yeah.
You know, you look around the countries and exercise is improving. The other group, recently I was in Portugal because they held their summer school for the Movement Disorder Society. And they've got a purpose-built neurological facility just outside Lisbon. And they run, they call it the boot camp. So again, on YouTube somewhere is this Portuguese neurological boot camp. And they've got this purpose-built facility. They provide hydrotherapy. They've got an outdoor gym. So if the center's closed, they have physiotherapy every day. They can stay there. They can come as outpatients. You know, so, you know, the exercise element is becoming as important, regardless of what your stage of Parkinson's is.
Okay.
So even if people are wheelchair bound, they are pushing higher intensity and actually watching people get up and walk, whereas before they would have stayed chair bound.
Interesting. So that's really interesting. I would never have thought that. We all know that exercise is really important, and is, you know, there's more and more evidence about how important it is for managing disease and aging and all those sorts of things. Mm-hmm. But I would never have thought that you'd have pushed people that hard. That's how important it was. So it's interesting to hear you say that. I'm going to have a look up that Rocksteady Boxing Group and add a link as well.
Yeah.
So the intensity of the exercise is really important, obviously. I'm assuming that people will still have individualized exercise programs as well for their specific presentation.
Yeah.
Is that still the case?
Yes, and that's where I think that to me is the physiotherapy specific issue.
Yeah.
I mean, you've got now exercise professionals who are training in providing general exercise. And, you know, obviously a boxer is better off training the boxing rather than
not a physio training people to box.
But I think where our skill is looking at individual change, the changes in the individual. So what is weakening? What is getting shortened in terms of muscle architecture or, you know, soft tissue changes, the joint position? And I will always, for me, feet are to me the most important, because you have people who, the moment you start becoming more unsteady, or the rigidity that's a part of the Parkinson's, and it is associated on the whole with older people, the feet are where a lot of the changes take place. And if you're trying to walk on this block of cement that's meant to let you actually accommodate to ground surface, changes in camber, but actually your supporting surface doesn't permit that, where on earth do you expect to get your good balance responses, your appropriate proprioceptive responses? You know, so as a consequence, people then stiffen up more, they're afraid of falling. So I think one of my biases, though, is because I was brought up with that sort of bow bass background.
Yeah.
And, you know, to me, I would first always think about mobilizing or at least checking feet.
Is that feet thing, is that specific to Parkinson's disease?
Oh, no.
Yeah,
I would say aging, but especially neurological conditions,
Your
stroke, your multiple sclerosis, you've got your diabetics who are losing sensation,
yeah,
who have a lot of swelling. So, to me, feet are ugly but important.
Possibly overlooked in lots of management of many patients.
Yes. So, you know, I run a lot of courses at the moment, and that's the one thing I'll always say to the patients, please wash your feet, because we're going to look at them. It's just, you know, the changes you can do within a 5-minute foot and lower limb treatment, just by loosening, giving them back their sensation, the movement to therefore balance the whole upper body.
Yeah.
You know, that to me is the most worthwhile 5 minutes, more so than, you know, just walking with someone. And one of my worries is that because of the resource difficulty, particularly in, you know, I witness it in the UK, you find that physiotherapists only have time to look at functional elements. Can they sit to stand?
Yeah.
So then they'll really work on strengthening the knees and the hips. And you think, well, is their fear of coming up to stand actually because they don't feel the ground, or because their ankles are so stiff, they cannot generate the momentum to come forward? You know, so
it's hard with the time restrictions that seem to be placed on a lot of practice these days.
Yes. But if someone only had 15 minutes at someone's house, I would say to them, you know, get to the feet of anyone who is older, has, you know, any condition that would impact on the tone around the feet, proprioception around the feet, and maybe even things like swelling. And once you've done that 2 or 3 times, you know, it takes 5 minutes.
Yeah.
Once you've done that 2 or 3 times, you often find that you can get the person, you know, soaking their own feet for a few minutes and wriggling toes, working ankles, and they'll often upkeep something that they feel the benefit of.
Mm-hmm.
But I suppose that then leads to one other thing that you do find in people with long-term conditions: motivation to continue something without the input of a health professional or an exercise professional.
So can we assist with that? What can we do to assist?
That to me is a very difficult one if we're talking about physiotherapy only.
Mm-hmm.
But I think where things like the voluntary sectors are coming in and the volunteers around, that to me is where they come into their own.
Yeah.
So trying to buddy someone up, or even knocking on a neighbour's door and just saying, will you walk them around the block? But, you know, obviously you have to choose your people.
Yeah.
But I think as a nation, and this must be happening globally, it can't just be in the UK, where, you know, we are becoming more sedentary. We're prone to seasonal changes which affect all our moods. So we have to find ways to motivate ourselves. Things have changed so much from when you had to walk to the bus stop,
yeah,
had to walk to work. You know, physical activity was just part and parcel of your life. You thought nothing of it. But now you find people, the moment they can't drive anymore or the family can't pick them up, they just stay at home.
Yeah.
And they're the sort of things that we're struggling to find solutions for, because before I would have said the council has to do something about that and they provide all these, you know, activity solutions. But with the cuts in their resources, we're finding that more difficult as well. So
that's a really interesting thing to tell people to be aware of and to sort of bring into their management of someone with Parkinson's disease, or anyone really who is elder or you know, less mobile. It's really interesting that we should take responsibility for trying to find someone to motivate them, because it can't be that hard to do. It must be easier than... It's easier certainly than us going around all the time to motivate them, which we can't do these days. But there must be ways, there must be ways, easy ways to do it that we can, as long as we're aware that we need to do that sort of thing.
Yes. I mean, one of the things I'll occasionally do, but obviously I can't do it for a long time, is if I know I've sent someone an exercise program through the post, I will always send it with, you know, a little calendar, and I'll text them every few days and say, how are you doing? You know, there's probably a long pause, and then there'll be a text back going, not so consistently. So I think sometimes if they know they're being watched, a little bit Big Brother style,
yeah,
but the fact that someone's going to take an interest, and I see a lot of families who... The work patterns are the other thing that have changed so much. Families now live away. We can't really ask families to do as much, but they can text, they can Skype, they can, you know, so to just say to grandma, you know, Wednesday, I'm going to Skype you. You better have done your exercises. And that's how I think I'm engaging families more and more.
Interesting.
Rather than saying, will you go round and make sure?
Yeah.
Because they can't, or they don't.
Yeah. So do you think there is, or is there, I mean, I haven't seen anything in relation to telemedicine and Parkinson's. Is there anything going on out there? Is there anything in place?
I think they're trying to develop things. They've watched what happens in, you know, with stroke. So when people are exercising, they're starting in stroke to actually pair them up. So you'll have someone on an arm exercise program opposite or Skyping someone else. They get quite competitive.
Yeah.
So practice. And there are signals about that. Or because exergaming is a big thing now, and they're looking at how, you know, whether it's Connect, Wii Fit, that sort of game, they're looking at whether they can form communities. So people can be at least online, almost like a Dungeons and Dragons version for Parkinson's. But I don't know how far these have progressed. And I don't actually know if there are places that have them, you know, formally set up.
Yeah.
Or if it's just the ideas now that we've got such good technology. But usually the way they use telemedicine is if someone is likely to be falling, it's to monitor the falls.
Yeah.
So it tends to be the monitoring after a crisis has happened, rather than using telemedicine as preventative,
as
fun, as interactive. So there's that social aspect. So we're not really used to utilizing it at that side, but there is the potential.
Definitely, it's an interesting concept. Maybe we should think about doing that, Barney.
Yes, okay. That'll be project number 2000 waiting on us.
Great, that's really great. I think there's some nice clinical pearls in there for people seeing, for physios seeing people with Parkinson's disease. What else are you involved in at the moment? Is there anything else ongoing with you that you'd like to share with us that we should know about that'd be useful for us to know?
Yes, the last thing then is, again, I'm afraid it's UK-based, so anyone sort of outside the UK, I do apologise. But we're trying to mirror the Netherlands version of, they've got something called ParkinsonNet. And it's a community of practice where you, if you train the professionals, they will then enhance the lifestyle for people with Parkinson's. And our Parkinson's UK are starting to set this up, and it's called the Excellence Network. So I would tell anyone interested in Parkinson's to actually keep an eye out, because we're going to try and connect across the country with people interested so that we can start advocating how to, you know, train people, give them basic training, say what is useful for someone who has Parkinson's, and actually start to look at what it is the people with Parkinson's want the health professionals to be able to do for them to help them live a good life.
That sounds like a really nice project. That sounds great. Yeah. You should keep us posted on that so that we can share that in the future, Barney.
Yes.
Definitely.
Yes.
I mean, you've obviously, I've never talked to you about how much you've done before, but you've obviously done so much work in the realm of Parkinson's disease and made such a contribution along with everyone else that you've mentioned. And I can totally see why you're now a fellow of the Chartered Society of Physiotherapy. So huge congratulations. I know that's really recent, but very well deserved, definitely. So thank you very much for talking to us today. We will share everything that you've talked about. We'll share the links that you've mentioned as well to everything. So everyone will be able to find all those resources. All those, you've talked about many resources, so we'll try and find links to them all. Thank you for talking to us today. I don't know if there's anything else that you'd like to add.
Yes, mine is just a thank you to everyone who... Because I know, although I was awarded the fellowship, it's like that little quote that behind every famous man is an amazing woman. And I just think it's the same. You can't get anywhere in your profession without the support and the love of either family, friends, the people that it matters to that then keep you passionate. So mine is just ending with a thank you to everyone who has supported me along the way, given me opportunities, and I just hope that I don't drive them as mad as I think I do.
You don't drive any of us mad, Barney. We're very pleased to have you and to have you working in our profession, so thank you.